What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Pete.
And we are coming to you live from a couple places on the internet. We're live on Facebook, LinkedIn, of course, for all your job needs, YouTube, Twitch, Instagram. We're not live on Kick today, which is very important. Unfortunate for the spammers who are trying to get us to sign up for stuff. So sorry, spammers. We'll be back with you next week. But Justin is not here because, and this is not a joke, he is understudying at the Metropolitan Opera tonight.
JT Sizzle, man. L.A. Justin, you know what I mean?
He's a fancy dude. It's not L.A. Justin, it's New York Justin.
He's a big deal. He's a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. We don't know if he's going to go on. He hasn't let us know yet, but it is opening night at the Opera, so he is there.
The Opera.
But that's okay. We have some awesome, awesome guests for you this evening. So why don't we bring in our first set of guests. They are two of the folks behind the hit webtoon and web series, Me, the Family Pet. Ladies and gentlemen, Gijo Sleeper and Monica Joy.
Hey, welcome. Hi.
So excited to have you guys here. So excited to talk about this series. So as I mentioned, it has been running on Webtoon for a while with billions of views. You made it into an animated series that is rolling out on YouTube and TikTok. Also, again, million of views, totally crushing it. But to take back to the concept and sort of like the initial fruition of this idea, both of you, I believe, have like a background in animation. So this feels like a natural fit. But why, what led to this in particular? What led to this idea and this collaboration?
I can start. So I'm Gijo Sleeper. I'm the creator of the series. And actually, it's kind of a funny story as to how this idea came to be. I came up with this idea when I was 9 years old. And nice. It was the product of a really unfair detention assignment. My teacher sent me on an errand to the office, and I'm pretty sure she had it in for me, because while I was away, she gave the class an assignment, and when I got back, I asked what the assignment was, and because I didn't know, she gave me detention.
So
I'm totally set up, exactly. I thought about suing when I was nine. I didn't. and so the detention assignment was to write a story about aliens, and I went home to complain to my mom because I wanted her to like call up school and fight on my behalf, and she was like, you know what, why don't you just blow them away with a really awesome story? And so I was like, mom. Mom taking the higher road. So I said, okay. So I sat down, and I actually still have the two books here. I filled up two books. And I created Sally, the family pet to a family of aliens. And, I held on to her for a really long time. I did show it to my teacher. She pretty much glanced at it and threw it, towards the trash. I managed to save it. But, not the most inspiring teacher. But, once in a while you get one of those. But the good news is I held on to the story idea. And many years later, I won't say how many because I don't want to age myself. But... many years later, I blew the dust off it because I thought it would make a fun kind of Garfield-esque comic. And so I started storyboarding little comics about Sally the pet human in a very kind of Garfield style. Kind of like, what if a pet human was, kind of causing trouble and mischief in an alien family household? And it just started getting really popular on Instagram. And that's when I think I met Monica. And Monica, you can kind of take it from there if you like.
Yeah, I fell in love with the same story. I thought it was amazing. Gijo and I were both tough, maybe trouble-causing little ladies. So I related to Sally very much. And I loved the webcomic. And then once we started talking about what it might become as a series, we stuck it out there on YouTube and TikTok. And a couple hundred million views later, here we are.
Amazing.
That's pretty crazy. So I'm actually curious to take a step back and say why Webtoon and why approach it in this way? We've had a bunch of Webtoon creators on this show, and everybody always has a very different answer as to how they tackle the format. Like you said, you've got a little bit more of a Garfield sense. There's a multiple panel for anybody who's listening to the audio podcast later and not looking at it right now. You got a multi-panel strip going on and multiple chapters there, but why was this the right place to start?
Yeah, as I said, it could have taken a lot of different forms, but because it started off as a Garfield-inspired idea, I wanted something that was comic kind of related. And Webtoon is really great, I think, for getting comics out there. I always kind of thought, like, how do I get this out to people? Because I work in the industry as my day job, and, you know, it's tough right now for new creators to get their ideas in front of people. And so I was trying Instagram, but Instagram is great, but it's not great for, like, linear storytelling because, you know, it's hard to scroll all the way back and get to the beginning of the story. And what's wonderful about Webtoon is it's really set up for linear-based storytelling. You can start at the beginning and you can just kind of click through all the comics. And so it seemed like definitely the best, you know, home for the series. So that's why I brought it to Webtoon. And, you know, I usually direct people to Webtoon as well as the best way to catch up on the whole story because there are 330 comics, right? Yeah. So it's a lot for Instagram. But that's why I think Webtoon was a good fit for it.
I mean, the other part of it is you have a pretty active fan base, at least that I could see on Webtoon, commenting constantly on every single strip. And that's a big part of it as well. Like, I think people look at Webtoon from the outside as like, oh, yeah, they're putting up comics, but it's almost a social platform in a certain way. So how do you embrace that? How do you use that? And does that direct your storytelling at all? Or are you just sort of like taking the comments in, listening to them, and then pushing them to the side?
That's a great question. And 100%, it absolutely does direct my storytelling. You know, I already know where this is going to go. Monica and I have a pitch Bible outlining Sally's story. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a lot of twists and turns on her journey as she goes from being like a pet human to actually saving the universe. I do kind of look to my audience sometimes in terms of like what characters are most popular. Perfect example is I introduced a couple of characters recently that I was just like, oh, they're going to be a one-off, you know, but they were so popular. I'll tell you, like, they're basically a nerd. There's a nerd named Pandia in the series, and she's kind of a geek. But the joke is that her pet human is like this, he's like this goth metalhead. And so they're complete opposite, but at the same time, they both love metal music. So she's this geek scientist, but she listens to metal and she rocks out while she experiments with her human. And I just introduced them to kind of move the story along, but they became so popular that I was like, okay, I need to weave them into the story more permanently because people were, you know, drawing fan art of them. And it was like, all right, I gotta. So to answer your question, yes, I absolutely pay attention to what the audience is saying. And if they really like a character, I think, well, how can I kind of weave this character in more to make sure that I'm supporting my audience? Because it is a community. And I want to make sure that, you know, we're building this community together. So
go ahead, Pete.
I just wanted to say, like, first off, congratulations. This is so awesome. I love the vibe of this. Just like reading it, it really kind of brings me back to when I was a kid reading Garfield and like the Sunday comics and all that kind of like magical feeling. I feel like you guys do such a great job of capturing that. It's also awesome to see you on like TikTok. Was it kind of crazy to have something that lived in your head, like the voice of a character kind of lives in your head, and then hear somebody kind of doing the voice? Was that kind of like fun or weird or any of the above to kind of have that happen?
It was amazing. I mean, I'm so lucky. Monica was really amazing at hooking me up with the talent, you know, because I didn't really know where to start. I wanted to start self-producing. I didn't really want to wait around for a studio to pick it up because, you know, the industry's struggling right now, and we had to figure out how can we just start getting this out there, because I do think that's the most important part of it, creating content, is to just get something out there. And so Monica was great. She was, you know, here's where you can go to find animators, here's where you can go to find voice actors. And I'm so blessed, you know, we have an amazing voice talent team now, amazing animators. My husband does a couple of voices, which is really fun.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so and it was great because it was just such a fun way to breathe life into the comics and really show, like, this is what I was envisioning in my head when I storyboarded the comic. And now here it is, you know, living on YouTube and TikTok, and you get to kind of see the gags play out and the beats and the timing, and it's fun. It's really fun to direct those little mini episodes.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because I was going to ask about translating it from the webcomic style to the animated style. So it sounds like from what you're saying, you already had it living in your head as the animation, and this is definitely the wrong word, but you almost like you reduced it down to those panels, to those stills, storyboarding it. So the animation is kind of like the final form in a certain way.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I work in animation, and so I've sort of been very familiar with the storyboarding process. And when I create my comics, I did it intentionally with, you know, six panels, always ending on either a joke or some kind of story. You know, especially as the series gets a little darker, you know, the six panels will often end on something like a reveal or something dramatic. But it's in very intentional in doing all of that, achieving all of that in six panels, because right now the idea is to produce these little mini shorts, and that's how people are consuming the content. Now, eventually the goal is to bring it to a broader format, maybe, you know, a series format, and then the style would obviously change very much in order to fit that format. But right now, this is the way that we feel people are kind of consuming the content. So the comics are very deliberately styled to kind of meet those needs.
And one other thing, I believe you made a deal, you were saying, with U2s, which if people don't know, those are figurines. They're not Funko Pops. They have very different eyeballs. It's a totally different thing.
Well, right here, actually,
Do you
yeah.
really?
Ooh, fun.
Get the toy.
Yeah,
Oh my God, yeah, look
awesome.
at it.
That's great. My son is obsessed with U2s. He's on the website like almost every single day, so I'll have to point him in the direction of these. But how did that deal come about? Because you don't normally like U2s, at least the way that I'm familiar with it through the expert, my son, is like, you know, you have a Stranger Things, you have X-Men 97, whatever. So how did you end up getting hooked up with this deal?
Yeah, you know, U2s is amazing. Like, they really keep their finger on the pulse of what people are consuming. And they reached out to me. I guess they,
Wow.
you know,
Oh,
they
wow.
must scour the internet, I assume, to see what people are watching, what they're consuming. And I guess they've seen the numbers, and so they reached out asking if I was interested in licensing the content. And they were just so great to work with. Like, just really responsive and excited. And you know, they have this down to a science in terms of how they create the prototypes and get the creators' input, and just really awesome to work with. And so, you know, I don't know how much I can say on here, because I know they have their marketing strategy, and I don't want to, like, you know, get a tip, step on any toes with that. But they have a whole, you know, drop coming up in January where these dolls will be available. And then, you know, depending on how they sell, we might do some others as well. So it's been a really great partnership, and I feel really grateful that they reached out, because it's been a pleasure to work with.
Now, based on everything you're saying, it definitely seems like, of course, the animation is the goal. That's what you're looking to do. But just to get back to the comics for a second, do you see them getting collected in any way? I mean, I know when we're talking about like Sunday morning strips, the things that I always loved was sitting down with my collections of Calvin's and Hobbes or Farside or anything like that and just obsessing and poring over them. So is there any thought towards that, or is the goal the animation at this point?
Yeah, you know, it's both, honestly. Like, I would love to do a series. I mean, that's kind of how I'm creating it, is to be a series. However, I would love to do a book. You know, right now we're in talks with some publishers, but nothing's come to fruition yet. But absolutely, I've been writing these as volumes. So there's like a kind of a big twist at the end of each volume, with the kind of anticipation that each volume could also become a season, you know. So they sort of align that way in terms of the storytelling. But, you know, we're looking for the right partner there. A lot of the publishers are looking for graphic novels now, and even though I completely understand that that's all the rage, and I get it, you know, right now, I do think there's still an appetite for those Sunday funnies, as you were saying, those Sunday comics, the Calvin and Hobbes style. And that's still the way that I've been boarding these. So I'm hoping that, you know, we do find the right partner, and that we can get a couple books out, because the audience,
Awesome.
fans, they're all asking for it. So I'd love to be able to deliver.
We
And
really,
Monica might have some thoughts on that too.
yeah, we really want somebody to share our vision. We know where the story is going. We have all the seasons laid out. The plot is there. The narrative is very linear. So as Gijo said, we're looking for a partner that's very special and wants to take the story where we want it to go alongside the community, not take it from its community, which is key.
Yeah, definitely.
This is all great, and the book is great. Before we wrap up here, obviously the thing to check out is Be the Family Pet, but just to give you another chance, is there anything else people should check out from you? Anything else you want to plug? Monica, anything you want to plug there?
Oof, that's a great question. I didn't come prepared with that, I'll be honest.
That's all right. It's just, where should people check you out socially?
People can find me. I'm very active on LinkedIn, randomly enough. I do have my own studio, Monica Violet Joy Productions. We do a host of all different things and projects. You can find me there. I have several books and series myself, but right now, let's stick to Me the Family Pet. That's why we're here.
All right. And Gijo, same for you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're looking to get more into the series, I recommend starting on Webtoon, as you guys said. That's a really good way to catch up on the whole story. And then the animations are following the comic, but they're a few years behind. So you can watch all the animations. I am planning on eventually streaming some of them together so that they'll be more linear. But I invite you to check out my TikTok, my YouTube, and my Instagram, and of course the Webtoon. So just look for Me the Family Pet, and everything should come up.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for coming out. Congratulations on everything.
Congrats.
I'm looking forward to having my son force me to buy a bunch of U2s. So.
Thank you so much for having us, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, there we go. Once again, it's called Me the Family Pet. As they mentioned, you can check it out on Webtoon, also on YouTube, TikTok, and presumably a couple of other places.
That stuffed animal looked like it was like just pulled right from the animation. It looked really awesome.
Pretty cool. That's awesome. We should get U2s made of us, Pete.
All right.
We could probably sell zero of them.
Yeah, I'll buy yours. It'll be fun. Like I have it hanging right here. You know,
totally. We'll get a note from U2s. Be like, that's weird. We sold negative units. That's never happened before.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Anyway, we have two more great guests for you this evening. Very excited to talk to these guys. They are two of our favorite writers working right now, and they are two writers who work as one, as a hive mind. Ladies and gentlemen, Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much. Really, really pleased to be here.
Yes. Very excited to have you guys on. Yeah. For anybody listening, I do want to mention you guys are in the same room for two slightly different angles.
Look how adorable.
You caught us in the middle of our work day. So it would sort of sit on either side and show you way too much of Colin's house, or take the same background.
Well, in my mind, this is how you guys write comics, like sitting right next to each other, kind of like poking fun.
I'm the left. I'm one hand. He's the other hand.
This is awesome.
It's not far off, though. We do actually work in person. We've worked in person together since we were like 21 years old.
Oh, wow. So last year.
Yeah, just last year.
Thanks. Yeah. But nothing better than we normally stare at each other from across the table, which is great because then you can be eyes on.
It's a good angle for you. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, yes, hello, sir. And then we can have that conversation before going back down into our riding holes.
Well, there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about. And of course, you are here to talk about, from IDW, one of my favorite series running right now, Star Trek, The Last Starship. But I want to ask you a question you've probably been asked 1 billion times, but we haven't asked you yet. What works about the partnership? Like, obviously, you guys are very joined at the hip. Like you're saying, you met in college. Clearly, it worked there. But partnerships usually have a limited shelf life, and you guys have been working together for a really long time now. So what is it about this that works so well?
Yeah. How do you not murder each other?
We're asking for nobody in particular.
It's actually, you actually just said something interesting because you were like, well, in college, obviously it's where the magic started. No contraire, sir. And I do think that this might be one of the reasons that we do function so well is when we first met, I hated him.
we were oil and water when we met. Yeah. Colin wrote me as the villain in one of his like student pilots.
Oh wow.
I'd left to go study abroad, and when I came back, my roommate, who was my best friend, had found a new roommate.
Oh.
So obviously it was my enemy for life. But then we started reading each other's works and becoming really excited about what the other person wasn't just as a person, but as a creative. Mm. Right. And there's something about it's really hard to be mad at someone when their work is so damn good. So we found that kind of mutual connection of work, which also, I think, in a lot of ways helped us get over the concept of personality.
Because we were so similar. And I think it was really important. I think when you're that age, you meet somebody and you're like, especially at like a small, like competitive film school where you're like, oh, like this guy's stealing my brand. Like this guy's taking my mm-hmm. whole, like they're jacking my whole style. Like, what am I going to do? I think a big part of our relationship was learning that we had unique styles, but they were something that only we understood, and that where other people see us and go, oh, they're so similar. We're like, we're really not, but we are, but we're not. And I think like figuring out that chemistry and learning what that was, it grew it like a friendship. In terms of like why I think it's special, I think it basically comes down to that. I think Colin has a skill set that I don't have. I have a skill set that Colin doesn't have. We teach each other every day. I learn stuff from him. I figure out stuff. I've recognized my own maybe shortcomings as a storyteller, or the places where I don't feel as comfortable, and vice versa. And we can kind of keep each other honest and keep each other growing and keep each other on a path that is very hard to walk. The sort of like long-standing, you know, career as a fiction writer of any kind really can be a really taxing endeavor, especially if you have a family or you have other responsibilities or you like to enjoy your life in any way, shape, or form, slaring over a computer all day. And I think the two of us really help each other live the lives that we want to live while also telling the stories that we love to tell.
Beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
I think that's why it works. And then why it's lasted longer than anybody else. I would go to, I asked this question of Akiva Schaffer from mm-hmm. Lonely Island.
Yeah.
I asked him once, not because we were like hanging out. I was like at a Q&A, but I asked him, I was like,
you easily.
I know. I mean, honestly, it could have. Like, we have friends in common, but like, yeah. I've never heard of the keeper. But I asked him, you know, you've worked with your high school best friends well into your adulthood. How do you keep it from blowing up? How do you keep that from being a limited partnership or something like that? And he was like, honestly, he was like, have you seen Popstar? I was like, yeah. He was like, it's basically that. Just always be friends first. Like, mm-hmm. talk honestly and earnestly first. Know that you approach each other with respect at all times. Like, so even when you're digging with the when we're in the middle of a story and Colin has an idea I absolutely hate, I'm not demonstrating that by being like, you're a terrible writer. That's not you do that. You approach by being like, he knows he's my favorite writer. So my goal is to be like, here's what I don't get about the story. Can I understand it?
Now let's argue because let's argue. Because the idea isn't right. If you don't get it, then the idea isn't right, or I'm not expressing it correctly. So this isn't a personal thing. He wants to understand what awesome thing is in my head. And then if I am able to articulate it in such a my beautiful way, and he's like, oh, I see it. It still sucks. Well, then okay.
But so that's the truth of it.
Well, and just to follow up on something you said, I don't know how much you could actually encapsulate this, but in terms of your different skill sets, does it break down to like one of you is the dialogue guy, one of you is the action guy, or is it really just more granular than that?
I think it used to. I think when we were like 21, 22, I think I could point at broader concepts and be like, and we used to, like in meetings mm-hmm. when people would be like, what do you do? You'd be like, oh, well, Colin's the big explosion set piece guy, and I'm the little black box character guy.
Mm-hmm.
That is no longer the case. Now it is, I would argue I'm as inventive at action as Colin is. I've had to be. We've been doing this for so long. If I hadn't been, we would have failed out a long time ago.
Well, it comes down to, I mean, circling it to Last Starship, right? I know that we are released issue 2, but not issue 3.
Yeah.
When we get to issue 4, fans are going to find something a little bit unexpected. No spoilers, but it is a much quieter, much more dramatic and personal issue. I think it's one of the best issues of anything we've ever written.
I'm really proud of it. Yeah.
But at the same time, writing my half, I'm like, there's no big sexy explosions. There's no car chases. I love that shit. So, but what I do when I sit down, it's like I have three people in a room and they're about to have really intense feelings. I want to write a scene that Jack will be like, oh shit, this is, I couldn't do any better. Right. And then like, that's the target. Right. So it's like, I think at this point we kind of
same. I'm always like, I always want to do a crazy action thing that Colin goes, what? Yeah, like, yeah, right. That's what we're always going to want to do.
It's hard being each other's biggest fans, but also by now it's like, we each have a little ghost of the other guy, like always there being like, I know exactly what he'd be thinking right now. And my little ghost Jack is always like, Colin, you're perfect. Everything you do is great. You've never done anything wrong.
Isn't, what a nice guy. What a
yeah,
guy.
Wow.
But yeah, that is really, I think a big part of it as well is that we are, by the nature of knowing each other's strengths and weaknesses to a really intense degree now, that we really couldn't unpack on this podcast if we tried. It's very instinctual. I think what we are now able to do is step into any scenario and not be like, what would he do? That's not the point. The point is like, what would I do in the space that we created together? Mm. And so every book is like an ecosystem that the two of us create together. And we create it pretty intensely. Every scene is laid out. Every page is laid out. We know what the thing's going to be, but then how it's actually executed, how the beat to beat of that scene works, that happens in an individual way. And then we get that great experience of getting to sit down and read the other guy's stuff and go, oh man, I love that. I didn't think I would never. I read Star Trek, Last Starship 8 today. We turned in issue 8 today. And there's a bit, it was my first time reading Colin's pages on that. And he did a thing that we hadn't talked about. It was like a formal thing that I didn't expect. And it was really great. I was like, oh shit, this is awesome. I love this. Like, I'm glad this is here.
We call it going rogue. And it's 50% win chance.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Last Starship specifically for anybody who doesn't know. And I'm going to give a spoiler warning here because wild things just happened even in the first issue of this book. And as you noted, issue 3 is coming out on December 17th. So plenty of time to catch up. But the concepts that are going on here, first of all, you've got the burn, which is a period that was hinted at and like kind of very quickly shown in Star Trek Discovery, but not really touched on at all, where all the dilithium of the universe or most of the dilithium of the universe explodes. It hobbles Starfleet. It hobbles everybody. So uncharted territory there. You have this starship goes out with a couple of very surprising characters from other places in the continuity. And then not only that, they decide to resurrect in his prime Captain Kirk to be on the ship. So there's a lot going on just like in the setup of this book. Plus you've got Klingons, plus you've got new characters you've got to set up, plus you've got to kill them off and bring them back and all these things. I mean, maybe I'm kind of like hitting the same drum over and over here, but given you've got all of these different big ideas jockeying, how do you make sure that's balanced and engaging in a first issue in particular?
So first issue, I would actually argue, is easier than second. I think this is a thing I've really learned over time, is that a perfect issue one, I think we've done it a few times. I'm really happy with some issue ones. I think you unleash us on a good issue one, we can do a great job. I think issue two is one of those things where it's a, it's like an endless horizon and figuring out what of your things to pay off next, what thing to really focus on, how slow to take something out or how fast to accelerate it. That can really make or break a series. And especially in comics, where issue two is really, I think, in a lot of ways, the test. People get in on issue one and they're like, okay, I'm in. And then if they read issue two and it disengages them, they're gone. It's so early. So I think part of what we try to do is always make sure that a big part of it is leave good room for issue two. The thing I keep saying about issue one of Last Starship is it's all table setting. All we're doing in Last Starship one is introducing you piece by piece to a whole bunch of different things that you, if you're not a Star Trek fan, don't know anything about. So let's pretend you don't know anything. Let's hope you don't know anything. I want people who don't read Star Trek comics or don't watch Star Trek to read this and watch this book. So let's imagine you don't know anything. You're going to read about Starfleet at its height. You're going to meet Captain Sato. You're going to encounter the burn. You're going to encounter what the Federation is and what Starfleet is in the aftermath of that. That's going to bring you to encountering his commanding officer and also the Borg. And then as you encounter the Borg through Agnes Jurati, who, again, you don't need to know who Agnes Jurati is. Mm-hmm. People who know Picard season two will see Agnes and go, what? But a new reader can just see a Borg queen who calls herself Agnes, which in and of itself should be weird enough, right?
I had a friend text me being like, who's this Jurati Borg queen you created? It's
incredible. Right, exactly.
Like, thank you.
And that's like, we're not overburdening you with like, here's all the Star Trek knowledge you need. We're just telling you the story in order, bringing you up to speed with characters and showing you the coolest, most interesting, most badass versions of those characters with sort of this like Star Trek definition of badass, and get you to a phase where I can show you the ship. And then once we've got the ship, now we just need to set up a threat. We get the Klingons there on the last page. It's all table setting. Issue one of Last Starship is like checking off all the things we need so that you can understand the story we're about to tell. And then I guess Kirk, right?
And then
leaving a billion questions that we can answer over the course of the entire series. Obviously, the biggest of which is, why is Kirk back? Mm-hmm. What is the plan there? And who is this new Kirk, and how does he feel, and what is he? Which is really what we decided to pick up on as our issue two plot, right? That's where you're like, that deserves time. That's a thing a reader can read. That's a thing that hopefully hooks them in for the rest of the book. Because if they don't like this, then they certainly won't like the rest of the series. So this will be a great way to like dig them in.
But I do think something that we learned with Last Starship, and it really did impacted us. Like, we learned this, and we are going to be utilizing it going forward in a very big way, is while we do hit all the points for you to understand the story, we don't belabor any of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, at no point do we really sit you down and talk about how da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba. We're assuming that you either can figure it out or don't need to know. And not knowing is really exciting for an audience. And I think as younger writers or with certain other editors, that mystery can look like a flaw. Right. What if we lose the? What if the audience doesn't understand what's going on? It's like, well, then fucking strap in, baby. But that's not really an answer that you can give at a lot of publishers.
Right.
Luckily, IDW and Paramount understands that, like, well, part of Star Trek is mystery. And yeah, we can slow roll this. Yeah. So our first issue, the thing that I am so proud of the first issue of Last Starship is how quiet it is. Mm-hmm. Even though we destroyed the world, we are still able to slow things down to have like almost entire pages of just emotion ravaging a character. And that to me is so much more impactful. I can't believe I'm the one saying this, but is so much more impactful than a giant sexy explosion.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's been it's been the lovely thing about the ongoing work with Star Trek. I think they've learned to trust us on that kind of thing. And that, mm-hmm. that we aren't sitting there constantly going, oh, well, we need to explain this. I think one of the beautiful things about working with Heather Antos especially is that Heather is very extremely knowledgeable about Star Trek, right? But she doesn't come to it like a fan does necessarily. Like, there are things that she is a fan of for sure, Beverly Crusher, but there are also places where she's like, make me care about this. Like, why am I reading this? Yeah. What is the point of this? What is that dynamic? And on Last Starship, that's so important because we're asking her to put herself into the head of a person who doesn't care about this at all and who has to understand why they care about it from the actual content of the book.
I do want to bring up a comment here on YouTube because I believe your artist, Adrian Bonilla at Adrian Bonilla Comics, says it's great for me too. I get to invent lots of new things for the Trek universe, and the art on this book is fantastic as well. So
yeah,
Adrian is here. I don't think this book works without the art by a fair margin. Adrian Bonilla is, I've never had to say this in front of him, genuinely, I think, a really like a next level artist. He's one of those guys who, when we discovered he was free for the book, we were shocked. Not because he's been like, doing a million books and how could we possibly get him, but just like, we were kind of shocked that we weren't already the biggest fans in the world of this guy.
Yeah, it's one of those ones we worked really hard to cast the book correctly, to find the kind of noir tone that still loves Star Trek but also could really do likenesses. It's a pretty hard sweet spot to nail. And sure. Then we saw Adrian's work and it's like, oh, it's like Q himself just kind of created a perfect artist to map her energy. And bada boom, we've got Adrian. And yes, his work has been consistently absolutely incredible, how he brings this stuff to life in a way that we have once again never really seen for Star Trek comics.
One of the things that we love about Adrian, just to keep, I know you didn't even ask about it, but I'm just going to keep praying.
Why not? Please.
So one of the things that I think is really valuable about it is on occasion you get to work with artists who are storytellers. I mean, all artists are storytellers in the comic book medium, but like you get to meet ones who want to dig into the beat by beat storytelling. They aren't trying to translate your script. They're trying to translate your story, and they're operating your script as a guide. Kevin Walker is like this. Kev Walker is the kind of artist who will give you notes on every page of your book. Like we get handwritten notes about, here's all the things I changed about your layouts. Here's all the ways I changed this scene to make, I thought this would make more sense. And when he's Kev, you're like, well, you're Kev Walker, so why am I ever going to argue with you? Yeah. The cool thing about Adrian is it's not about change, but Adrian's interpretation of scenes leads to him oftentimes adding panels to scenes.
Yeah, he does.
Which we're always really cognizant about not giving too many panels to an artist. Yeah, that can really overburden them, especially after our time at Marvel where the rule is like 4 to 5 max. We were like, which is impossible for us.
On Hacktivist Volume 2, we gave a Marcus a 36 panel double page spread.
Yeah.
So like, look, problem.
Yeah, where it's just, we like panels. What can we do? But the cool thing about Adrian is he also likes panels. So you can see there's this great, there's a few beats, especially in 2 and 3, where he adds like 2 or 3 panels into a sequence to give it a different kind of rhythm and have it feel a certain way and have the looks operate in a certain way and to understand what's going on in the character's head that weren't written in the script, and then allows us to actually take dialogue out of the book because visuals are doing the storytelling, which is, just such a treat for us as writers who are trying to take words out of this book.
It's got Mignola energy.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We all know on Hellboy, like one of the most beautiful stories is like Pancakes, where it's him looking at pancakes and it's just these little panels of pancakes and butter. It's like, yeah, it's a 4-panel comic, but it's a bunch because it lets you feel the tone of the space. Or like just a cut in on a flower, like those kind of small moments that you need to let a
tweet,
story
tweet
breathe.
Bird. Tweet tweet bird. Tweet bird, man. It's the Mignola special. I put we put a tweet tweet bird in Giant Size Dark Phoenix Saga. There's a tweet tweet bird. That's our hat tip to Mike.
Anyway, gosh, nice. We can talk about Adrian for a long time, but it's just very cool to kind of be in the same room as him.
Yeah.
We got another question for the comments here on YouTube. This is actually from our co-host who is a big fan of your guys and unfortunately couldn't be here because he is, and I believe I said this earlier, but not a joke, understudying at the Met tonight. But he says, so many of your stories are big blockbusters, and I believe he's on stage at the Met right now, so probably shouldn't be doing this. So many of your stories are big blockbusters. How do you know when a story is big enough ready? What's the smallest, most contained story you've done together?
That's a fun two-parter. Man, that first question is a doozy.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we don't.
Yeah. It's true. The stories I would point out that are the ones I'm not as big a fan of are the ones where we don't know when to stop.
Sometimes, anime has a problem with power scaling, right? And like what we have a problem with is getting we love each other's work so much. It is so core to our process to yes and. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can yes and yourself into absolutely wild situations.
Oh, yeah.
You do need to get out of. The flip side of that is, so for Power Man Timeless, we looked that directly in the eyes and we were like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted.
It needs to be the biggest possible story. So we're going to make it absurdly large. Mm-hmm. And it would have been even larger had we had that last issue, right? The last issue kind of got truncated. So as a result, like we have to do really, really big stuff in really, really small packages. And I think that's generally when you know a story is too big or is big enough, right? How do I know when a story is ready? Has nothing to do with the scale of the story.
Yeah.
We know that a story is ready because we can describe the entire story without any of the set pieces on a black box theater. That's the test we do. We say, could these characters do this story without any of the props, set pieces, science fiction nonsense? Last Starship, at its heart, is the story of a group of survivors of a traumatic event making their way through the aftermath of that traumatic event, trying to piece the world back together, but learning that they need to piece themselves back together. That's Last Starship. Once I can tell you that story, it's ready to go. And everything else will come out in the wash. In fact, we will get to issue 7 or issue 8 or issue 9 of Last Starship, and we'll look at it and go, this needs to turn up, or this feels too low in stakes, or this feels too high. And like, we'll do those adjustments on the fly. But the thing we will absolutely know before we go into any large scale story is where it is going and how it is going there. It's one of the reasons why superhero comics can be kind of tough for us, actually, because some characters aren't allowed to arc, or it's harder for them to arc, or frankly, just readers don't want them to arc. There's a lot of characters you kind of want them to just be like icons. Yeah. And we're pretty bad at static icons. We don't really. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because we come from Hollywood where that's sort of verboten, or maybe it's because we just are, you know, Aristotle pilled. I don't know.
Bendis pilled.
Yeah, we're definitely Bendis pilled. But like, I think we really like change over time. We like evolving characters. It's why like my proudest work, I think, and the most intimate thing we did in comics was Bucky Barnes over the course of the whole Revolution saga is a pretty intimate look at a guy dealing with trauma and guilt, primarily guilt, and recognizing what his guilt and legacy mean in terms of those frameworks. Story.
I got a cheat.
Yeah.
Well, was our Batwoman, was that an inventory issue?
The Batwoman inventory that never came out? Yeah.
We wrote a Batwoman inventory issue that came out.
That took place in one room.
That was her like trapped in Bruce's holographic training simulator. Technically, that would be a one room drama. I mean, I guess that was Grayson. We wrote a Grayson issue that eventually it took place entirely with him falling from the sky.
Yeah, but
so while the sky is contained. Very big, it is pretty contained towards the immediate vicinity of his body as he hurtles towards death.
I don't know that it's contained in the way that we're talking about physically, but the most emotionally and like storytelling contained story I think we've ever done in comics is One Bad Day Clayface.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Clayface is concerned with one thing and one thing only, which is Clayface's state of mind, which is, you know, how Basil's going to get through this day and how it's going to destroy him and all the people around him. You know, it doesn't get much bigger than that. Batman doesn't show up until page like 38 or something, right? Like, no. And I think that's why it's one of our proudest works. Like, we really love containing. And that's something we're doing in Last Starship, too. Last Starship is not contained, but I think emotionally it's contained.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we're done with this interview, I'm going over to my shelf of all of our books, which is right over there. And I'm going to mind's eye my way through everything we've ever written and find like what story has the smallest geographical footprint.
Physically, I almost guarantee it's the thing we just wrote that isn't in comics. We just wrote a new pilot that is actually fully contained. Yeah, but it's not a comic, so it doesn't count.
While we're talking about all your works, I just want to take a moment and just say from the fans, thank you. Because when you see your guys' name on a comic, there's this kind of nerdy excitement that you get as a reader. And I just wanted to kind of take a moment and just say, like, I don't know how hard it's been for you guys from the beginning, but to where you are now. But just as a reader, it's exciting to see your name on a comic and to open up a book and not know what we're going to get, but know you're going to love the shit out of it. So thank you so much.
Wow, Pete. Thank you. That means a lot to us, honestly.
Well, it means a lot to us, too. So just thanks so much, man.
It's a joy. I mean, you know, we met because we had to get into our friend's car and go to the local comic shop together. Paul and I didn't have cars. Our buddy David, the one from the story earlier.
The roommate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whose house I was literally at playing video games last night. Marvel Cosmic Invasion buddy. Dave had the car, so he would drive us to the local comic shop. And we became friends and not just like guys who liked each other's work was by reading comics together and eating pizza and talking about exactly that feeling of like, oh, what are the books that like I show up at this store and I know I want to read these ones first. Right.
Yeah.
I have those writers. I mean, Bendis is, I think the one that we like Bendis and Morrison were the ones that I think we could all agree on. Maybe Dave a little bit less, on Morrison. But like, I think that we've generally been able to agree on who the people are who are like that. So for us, I think that's always been people like Matt Fraction and Brett Mendes. And I think the minute that we got to work with any of like the big two, our goal was always like, pay tribute to this the way that they did. Make it feel like something that felt like it came from us, that came from a true knowledge of these characters and a love of these characters and a lifelong kind of like dedication to it, while at the same time really trying to push the character, really trying to make sure that it felt new and fresh and modern and anchored on the character itself. So if we've been able to give that feeling to other people, awesome. Yeah. That makes me very, very happy.
Good.
I do want to return to something you said earlier about the trouble you have writing superheroes because their arcs are mostly static. So what about Star Trek, which has generally we had Heather on the show a couple of months back, and she was talking about how one of the nice things about Last Starship is it is this uncharted period. So certainly you could kind of like go out there and go off the rails if you want to. But you wrote a fantastic run on the main Star Trek book, and that was very much between the rails. You had the start point right before it, you had the end point right after it. So what works about that for you that doesn't necessarily work about superhero comics?
So
most of the time
we are blessed to have been writing our stories between raindrops, and not between raindrops of the shows, but raindrops between milestones, right? Like Star Trek Year 5 is between the animated series and the motion picture, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a massive sea change for Kirk between the end of the show and coming home to be an admiral and facing the burden of the chair. So that has an arc inherent to it. So we were able to actually tell that story, which otherwise hadn't been essayed, right? We knew that Benjamin Sisko was going to come back, and we knew he was going to have to be gone again. But what he got to go through in that process was completely up to us to execute. And similar with like Beverly Crusher or a lot of the next gen folks, we saw where they ended up or we saw where they were. And then we know what they were going to end up in Nemesis, right? And then for Beverly, especially, then we know that she was going to leave for 20 years, right?
Yeah, she's going to torch all of her friendships and disappear. Fascinating place to take a character.
So while the shows did have the characters in relatively static positions, the movies actually did let them grow. And because we kind of got to fit in that box, we had the privilege to be able to have it. We knew what the arc needed to be, but it's rarely about the journey with these characters. It's about, or rather the, not the destination, but the journey that you get to go on. And the journey with superhero characters can't be emotional, right? They can go on that emotional journey, but it is much harder because you need to put them back exactly where you found them. So it'd be much more like writing between episodes of television rather than a kind of sea change from TV to film.
That's a really good point. I think it's occasionally you can do sea changes, right? I like to think that we did one with Bucky, but I think inevitably that character,
we got 25 issues to
40 almost.
Almost 40 issues to take Bucky from I'm not sure about myself to I'm pretty sure about myself.
Yeah, like we were able to take him along a journey. I feel like that journey had a nice chunk of change in it. We were able to get him there. But at the end of the day, that character goes back in the box. It goes next to Sam Humphries, who's going to write that character in a way that's informed by all the things Sam loves about the character, not what we love about the character. And that's okay. That's right. Like that's the right. Sam's also a close friend, so it was very nice to be able to hand it to him at the end. It felt very safe for us. But
that's
like,
cool.
I think a lot of what we're trying to do whenever we get on a superhero is find a slight change that feels like a sea change. Or in the case of Guardians was kind of the flip of that, right? Our Guardians run starts by us saying, okay, what if we start the characters at a place that is fully removed from what people understand about these characters? What if at the beginning of this book, these characters have lost hope, they have lost themselves, Gamora is drinking, Nebula is acting like a robot, like Peter is putting on a like cowboy affectation so that he doesn't have to deal with the heartlessness of like how he has to act, like that everybody, you know, that Rocket is just gone, yeah, has a robot eye now and a robot leg, like that we're going to break these characters fundamentally, and then that gives us an arc.
Yeah.
So that over the course of that series, from Groot Fall to Groot Rise, which is itself an arc, we're going to take you on the journey of these characters, recognizing and reappropriating their heroism and their hope, and reuniting with all of the Guardians that they've lost, all the people who were so mad at us for killing, who were just there at the end, waiting for the arc to be done, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm never gonna,
and I think we
can't kill all the Guardians of the Galaxy. No matter what we do, we could kill all of them 100 times; they would never die.
And I think that's not
the point.
this lens is and maybe a bit more specific in how we should be phrasing this, because to their immense credit, Marvel was like, "Fuck yeah,
yeah." This is
ruin the Guardians' lives, make them miserable.
We are never criticizing Marvel on this stuff. That is not what this is. It's a difference of form and like what's expected of it, I think.
Yeah. Yes. we love all of our parents equally. They're all great. But what sucked about Guardians is the love you all. I'm sure none of you on the internet, especially you, stray bullet. Great Guardian run. We appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Not everyone agreed.
Yeah, we got a lot of hate for that. Guardian.
Really? Oh, man, it was such a fun. Oh, I loved it.
Thank you.
A lot of folks want the thing that they want, and when you give them something else, they don't like that.
Yeah,
sure.
But especially when you say, obviously, and we couldn't say this, but were we to be able to say, hey guys, just wait 10 issues, and then you're going to get your toys back in the box, just like you like them. that's not something that works. And it's not that we don't enjoy writing superhero comics, because we love them.
Very much do. It's a blast.
Superhero comic fans can make the experience less savory.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, I'm just curious to keep pressing on this a little bit. What about something like Outsiders? Like, I love that run, but you've got two characters that I think aren't used as much, like Batwoman and Luke Fox are in there.
Which was the original brief. Can you guys give us something with Luke Fox and Batwoman?
that was the entire intention of that, was let's take these two characters that they can't figure out how to, I mean, they're very open, like they couldn't really figure out how to make them sell. They wanted them on different teams. They wanted to do different things. They came to us. They gave us almost 6 months to think about like what we wanted to do with them and how we clean them up, and pitched a lot of different versions just between the two of us. But it wasn't until we hit upon the planetary framework, right? Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for anybody who didn't read Outsiders, but the book's been out now, so too late. Surprise, it's a stealth sequel to Planetary, and it's a planetary about Planetary. Mm-hmm. The thing we loved about, like, that book meant a lot to us. I deeply love Planetary. It is one of the greatest pieces of comics fiction.
True shared Bibles.
Yeah, I would go back to it forever. I love it deeply, so to not pay tribute to it would have been silly, I think. To pay tribute to it was, of course, hubris, but that's why we're here in comics. You aren't brave. What are you doing here? Like, break the toys, have fun. These things are so much more powerful than you. You can't overpower them. So have fun with them and make them into something. I think the cool thing about Outsiders with the fan base for me was that at the time, I had a lot of Luke Fox fans coming to me and saying, I'm so happy to see Luke getting respect in a book and getting to do something. And I had a lot of Batwoman fans. There were Batwoman fans who hated what we did, but there were some Batwoman fans who came to me and said, look, they're giving her a spotlight to actually do stuff. Like in the Batman Mind Palace issue, we get into a whole thing about like what Batwoman means inside of that mythos. Like, we're really giving this character some props and we're trying to move her towards an interesting space. And then you would be like, yeah, have you read Planetary? And they'd be like, what is that?
And we sold more issues of Planetary
than we did of Outsiders, for sure.
Like, we want this. Get Planetary. Yeah. Go get the omnibus and then come back to us.
Yeah. But then people would show up at our booth and talk to us about it at cons, but now especially, what happens is people who are big Planetary fans come and go, I can't believe you did this. This is so cool. How did you get them to let you do this? How did this happen? This feels like a miracle. And like that kind of thing feels great. So like my counter argument to, I understand what Colin's saying about like working inside of any fandom, the fandom can make that tough, because if you listen to the voices that are drawn negative at you, and certain fan bases, like the X-Men fan base, for instance, plug their negativity pretty high, so mm-hmm. it's hard not to hear it. That can be weathering on people who don't have as thick skin as maybe others.
What are you saying?
Oh, no. No, Colin.
Well, wait, just to bring it back to Star Trek then for a second. You may be aware there's some not great people in the Star Trek fan base.
I've never heard that. Never once.
Which is almost like antithetical to what Star Trek is supposed to be about. What has your experience been like on this?
That one is, I think, very easy. Honestly, that you can just tune that out. Paul and I always say, like, if you don't get Star Trek, and you're a Star Trek fan, like, then cool. Like, I don't owe you anything, because mm-hmm. at its fundamental core, unlike almost anything else, Star Trek is about some stuff. Like, Star Trek is not like just a character drama. It's not a fun escapist thing. It is a social fiction about how we live together, how human society works, how we evolve, what we become.
How mandatory empathy is, and like there's stuff that we just cannot sacrifice.
We're not making Star Trek political. Star Trek is inherently political. And so one of the things that we do is, rather than trying to come in and go, we're going to make Star Trek political, we just write Star Trek. And if a fan comes at us and goes, how did you write that, make that political? I can point to 50, 60 now years of Star Trek and be like,
enjoy one of them.
Yeah, and I don't feel like I need to get into those arguments. On Guardians, I think we felt a kind of,
there's a 1-2-3 here that I think is really interesting, because the thing about like a Guardians fan or an X-Men fan is they're going to have a radically different vision of what the story should be than you do,
which is totally fine.
They might love what you're doing, but what's in their head that they want isn't any less valid than what's in your head. And that can really fuck with you if someone's like, I love this and you've done me dirty. And it's like, well, fuck, I love that you love this, so I do want it. I wish we could have found a middle ground.
Yeah, I get very sad when like a Star-Lord fan read issue three of our Guardians of the Galaxy, which is sort of our like Star-Lord issue. If they read that issue and they walked away and said, I didn't like that, I'd be sad. Because I think that issue is a great piece of Peter Quill content. And that's a Peter Quill story we worked hard on. And you want somebody to like that. Of course you do.
But with outsiders, if people are like, I don't really get it, you're like, okay, bye, Felicia. Planetary, you're like, you're a real head, man. I do not need 10,000. I don't need the numbers. This book is not for everyone. It is an incredible 12-issue experiment for a very, it turns out, I thought it would be everybody. 11 issues. I thought everyone loved Planetary, but it turns out that is a relatively narrow slice of the comic buying population.
Yeah, we were shocked.
It's for you. You're the guys. And then in Star Trek, it's really easy because you either get it or you don't. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's like, I think people who get Star Trek love what we do because they understand that we get Star Trek. We are them. And we are just trying to tell these incredible stories. If you're going to finger wag at Star Trek because like how can you get political or what? I don't even know the kind of logical hoops you need to jump through to kind of defend that stance. To me, it's kind of like, oh, we're kind of in wackadoo town and I wish you luck in your tinfoil hat.
I think, I think Star Trek is, it's been a wonderful place for us to play. And now as we've been able to step back from superhero comics for a minute, which is very sort of like intentional move by us to be like, we want to do like one book. You know what I mean? We want to get to that stage. And we said, we're going to step back. We're just going to do Last Starship. We're going to take everything we've learned in superhero comics, everything we learned on Star Trek, everything we've learned elsewhere. We've been story leads on a video game for the last like 4 years. We have a lot of like learnings. We wanted to bring that all to something that was as close to something we created as we've done in a long time. And Last Starship was the effort to say, what if we built something that was just for us and then people will show up or they won't? And it was a big gamble. I think that's the big thing, is that for us, all these other things, NYX, as much as it seems like a gamble, people will pick it up. It's an X-Men book. Mm-hmm. Like NYX, you know, only lasted 10 issues at Marvel, but it was in the top 10 sellers every week it came out. Like it's not that you aren't doing a successful book. It's just that the metric for success at Marvel and DC is extremely high.
Yeah.
With Star Trek, we know what these books sell. We manage that. We know what we think the sort of cap is. Great. Let's try to blow that open. Let's see if we can invite new fans in. this isn't about getting Star Trek fans on board. This is about getting every person that we've met at Marvel in DC who came to us and said, you know, I'm just not a Star Trek person, which you hear all the time. All the time you hear this. Anybody who reads, you know, who loves Outsiders or loves this or loves that, you say, well, have you read Star Trek? That's the one that's got like the Eisner nods. And they'll be like, I'm not a Star Trek guy. And it's like, I want to make a book for them. We're going to make a book that's targeted right at them and tells them you can be a Star Trek person. Here's all the cool things about Star Trek all packed into one book. You're going to find something to love in here the same way that we did.
Without lying about what Star Trek is.
Yeah.
Right. This isn't, we're not giving you a gun slinging action adventure and calling it Star Trek, right? Which I think is just one of the things that I'm so proud of us for, pat ourselves on the back. Like, we're giving you hallways and carpets, right? We are carpeted hallways, baby. And it is gripping, if I can once again pat ourselves on the back.
I appreciate you.
That's what Star Trek really needs to be, is like, can it be done in a black box?
Yeah.
Right. Can it be done in a carpeted hallway? And if it is, if it can, then you got yourself a Star Trek.
Yeah. And the fact that people have shown up for it, that fans have been reading it, that the reviews have been what they have been, that the sales have been what they have been, the fact that we're at second printing for issue one, all of these things are like, to me, are a really great renewal of that love of fandom, right? Across the board. That's some of our Marvel fans, that's some of our DC fans, that's some of our Star Trek fans.
And new fans. A lot of people who have no idea.
People who have no idea who we are, who are picking it up because they read about it somewhere, they saw this interview. People who are coming in on this book are making their own little like Last Starship community. And that to me is extremely like special. That's something we haven't really had before. And it's been a joy to get to be involved in that and sort of see that start to build.
Awesome. I do want to ask you about something that is off from comics, but you have a movie that you wrote called Synthetic that I believe is in post-production. Given that you started this journey at film school and now you have this film potentially coming out at some point soon, how does that feel? Good, I imagine.
Yeah, it feels good, my friend.
Yeah,
it's lovely. Yeah, it's without being able to say too much, or like, you know, we're gonna save this for the DVD commentary. What a long journey, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing in this town gets made easy, and the longer the process takes, the harder it actually is going to become to actually make something. This town loves talking about making things and then actually making nothing.
Yeah.
The director and kind of producer on the project, Oliver Ridge, fought tooth and nail every step of the way.
For years. We wrote this movie almost 6 years ago.
And he is a man who is, you know, one of his specific superpowers is finding money. So when he like, no money, you know things are bad.
Yeah.
And yet he never gave up. He kept pushing this project. Once Charlie Cox got involved, things really started hitting the road.
And Charlie was like kind of our like number one for this role. It was wild that we got him. We effectively wrote the part for him. We got very lucky. He told me a whole story about like why he did the thing when we first met. And I'm very thankful for him for being so gung-ho about jumping into a project that was a little movie, but that he really believed in and he loved the script. Carl and I have had a lot of experience on like big studio films that have never been made. You know, we've been like working writers for a long time, but it's a real slog. We've written on a couple of shows that then got canceled before they got made. Like we're really in that stage.
Like the hardest working writers in Hollywood you've never heard of.
Yeah, not that you haven't heard of, just they haven't had anything made. Like it's been really tough. And so Synthetic kind of coming out of the blue like that was and is a real blessing. We're very thankful for Ollie for bringing us in on it. I can't wait to see how the movie turned out. I was on set. It looked incredible. But yeah, they're editing it right now. So I can't wait to see. I was just texting Ollie yesterday. I'm sure we'll see a cut soon.
Are you guys going to do the comic book adaptation of the movie as well?
No, it's a movie.
That's one of the things that we
don't turn your movies into comics. Don't turn your comics into movies. Maybe just have them be great comics and have them be great movies.
Are you going to have cameos at least or something?
One of our books has a
cameo. Oh, really?
Nice. Yeah,
we have a book that we have the license for. That book made it into the movie.
That's awesome.
Along with a few other people, I think a couple of Frank Barbieri's books are in there. Like I think there are a few of Ollie has a lot of. He's a comic book nerd. Yeah. Ollie, he's like he loves comics. He collects original.
He's a very
art.
Sexy, very tall, very blonde British gentleman, posh British gentleman. Who is also a big comics book nerd.
How dare he?
What
you can't be both. You're not allowed.
Garbage.
But he has some great stuff.
Uh,
Well, that's awesome.
Again. Yes, Adrian. And you'll draw it. We'll do it all together. Honestly, if Adrian and us don't do a Daredevil run together someday, I will be mad. He's so good for it.
Yeah, Adrian
would be so good for it. Like, we're either going to do Batman or Daredevil, one of the two.
What do you want to do, Adrian? Let's work it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can do both. They're doing crossovers again now.
I guess.
Yeah. Like we were talking about, Last Starship is absolutely amazing. I'm loving it. There are two moments in issue 3 that made me gasp out loud. They're just great. I can't wait for people to read it. Before I let you go, though, obviously, this is the thing. This is the thing that you're working on. Like you said, you're really focusing on this. But is there anything else you want to plug? Anything else people should be checking out or looking forward to?
Well, I mean, we just got done talking about Synthetic, which is great. We can't tell you when that'll come out or how, but it will at some point. Colin and I are the currently, he's going to the bookshelf.
I love it.
Colin and I are the are two of three writers. I'm the head writer. We have Colin and then Jody Hauser on a video game project called March of Giants. March is a sort of League of Legends competitor that'll be launching later. It's not out yet. We just did our closed alpha, so I can't really plug that anymore, but it's a original IP, like a story universe that we all created together alongside this incredible team at Montreal Games. I can't wait for people to see what this thing is going to be. It's I think going to be really special. And it's been a joy. So keep an eye out for March of Giants. Maybe put it on your Steam wish list. That's like probably the best thing you do. It's free to play, so you're not even spending money. That one's an easy move for me.
We just signed a contract for another incredible project that could not be more different than Star Trek that we're insanely excited about.
Yeah.
We have a creator-owned that's currently in the oven, but is not yet. No one can even smell it baking yet.
Nope.
And in the meanwhile, people think when you're out at the shop picking up Last Starship, number one, because you're like, oh my God, this sounds so cool, you should also take the time to pick up Power Man Timeless. The trade is out now. It has the original Timeless issue plus the four issues of Power Man Timeless. Bernard Chang draws the shit out of it.
Just killer.
Talk about power scaling. Like, we destroy Mercury itself. We put the entire threat to Earth. Like, this book does not get bigger. We
raise Araco. Yeah, it's a crazy book.
We kill Apocalypse.
We do a lot of
things.
We do a lot of things in four issues in Power Man Timeless that most books would take 20 years to do.
We have no time.
We did it.
It's timeless.
It's timeless.
All of Dragon Ball Z in like 90 pages.
Nice. While also deeply essaying trauma and what it means to give into your darkest impulses, even though you're supposed to be the best version of yourself.
Yeah. So check out Power Man Timeless.
There's a lot going on in that book.
That one really flew under the radar pretty hard for like a lot of reasons. Would really recommend you guys check that one out and trade. I think we're really proud of it. And honestly, just Bernard's work as an artist is next level.
So. Yeah. Strip all the Power Man out of it, and you end up with just Luke Cage in a black box. Once again, right? That's the story that works. And then we put all of the incredible goop on it.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on everything. Can't wait for everybody to read Last Starship, play the game, see the movie, everything that's coming out. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Congrats on everything.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you, Alex.
Okay, there we go. Once again, Star Trek, The Last Starship, number 3, is coming out December 17th from IDW. Definitely check it out. It is biznonkers. That's a real word and everything. And you can get caught up. The two issues are on stands now. And like they said, for real, I know it's hard for me to distance myself as a hardcore Star Trek fan, but it's very engaging. And it takes these wild ideas that from a lot of other places in the Star Trek universe maybe shouldn't work, but they absolutely do in this book. So highly recommend it.
Awesome. Yeah.
And folks, we're going to move on with our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It is your audience questions.
All right.
And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments and we'll get to it. It could be about absolutely anything. And Pete, what you drinking tonight?
Oh, I don't have a garage, but I got the beer. You know what I mean?
Excellent. Glad to hear it. I'm drinking water just to help there. And we've got a special guest.
Oh my God.
Coming in
live from Matt.
Live from the bed. I can hear the music. Justin Tyler, welcome.
I'm in the cover room here. Usually it is this full of people.
Oh, you're kind of breaking up a little bit. Is that the opera getting?
Yeah, that's it's the end of the tour.
Okay, we can barely hear you.
Yeah,
because the opera is so loud.
Or your microphone sounds like it's underneath your
or
shirt.
Or you're whispering. Or maybe, you know what? Route it through the Metropolitan Opera System sound system and see. Oh, there we go. Now it works.
Hey, yeah, hey. I'm here. Usually this room is full of other people, but they're not here. So I don't know what's happening. But I get to talk to you guys. Great interview.
Hey, how's it going? How's the show going?
Yeah.
Good.
Are you on stage?
It started a little late. No. I only go on if the other guy doesn't show up, so that's okay.
So but I other do guy know my showed lines. Up.
He's here. He's out okay. there. I just have to wait until. And the Zen man. Can we get a quick aria? I do not sing. I play a detective who is not nice. That's.
I see. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't cast you as that, but you know, that's the thing about acting. You know what I mean?
Well, that's we got a couple of questions here. If you got time before you got to go on and sing your aria, I believe is what we.
Yep, that's what it's called.
Derek Maynard says, Kelly and Lansing talked about realizing when they clicked as a creative duo. Was there a similar moment for CBC?
We're hoping to have that.
Yeah. Okay.
We're very close, I feel
fingers
like.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Do you guys remember, like, when do you feel like it clicked?
I have a weird moment where we had many meetings in New York City. Where we kind of pitched us two shows and two companies. And for me, it clicked when they were like, what's your guys' deal? And we just, me and Justin got into an argument on the spot. And then Zalbin had to try to like calm us down. And that was a fun, for me, I was like, yeah, we've got it down to a science. Like we can kind of go into bits and kind of go into, so for me, that was when I was like, oh, yeah, we can turn this on and off.
Leave it for you to say that it was an argument that got us on the same page.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we had that first meeting and started getting into the show. I think it was like probably when we've said this a million times, but we had three shows that we did before the holidays went away. And they were like fine attendance. They were not sparsely attended, but like. Totally fine for a Tuesday night. Then we came back after the holidays completely packed to the gills, and it was comic book fans because I think by that point it had been written up in the New York Times or something like that. And I think that we were able to transition from we're just doing a show on a regular Tuesday night at the Pit to something a little bigger than that. That certainly felt to me like, oh, okay, we can do this. We can keep doing this. We will never stop doing this.
We will do this until one of us dies.
Schreckler says, what are your co-host skill sets that you don't have? Well, Pete knows how to use the nunchucks, and I just do not. So that's one.
Nunchakos. Self-taught.
I'm learning. I'm trying to take Pete's spot.
I don't know.
I don't know. Is this an opportunity to big up each other? Justin has to go.
He's
got
to go on stage.
Him, but I guess
I can't compliment you guys. I have to get out of here.
He's like, I don't want to do this. I'm leaving.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I will say that I think Justin, I tend to prep a lot for interviews, and Justin is better at being conversational in them. So he usually is better at that part of the interview, I think.
Yeah, the improv background, I think, is what helps him kind of be in the moment.
Sketch background. I got to write it out in
advance. Yeah, you got to write it out, yeah. I always say Alex is the smart one, and then me and JT just kind of have fun during the show, so...
well, also, I couldn't possibly do trivia, Pete. So.
Well, you would probably do real trivia,
which nobody wants. You couldn't make me do trivia. You could not. I could not.
You've
do
done
that.
It in my absence, so don't. Yeah.
Eric MCI says, question, do you sip or suck soup? Great question.
Oh, no. Don't do it. Don't.
Sip? No, I'm not going to do anything. I sip it. What do you do, Pete?
Well, that's that whole. Well, we were doing a bit before about sucking soup. I think that's what they're, Eric is, it's a callback.
It is a callback. What specifically? We say a lot of things.
You can't remember the bit?
No.
You don't remember Justin talking about go suck some soup?
I don't.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, Eric, thanks for trying.
Thanks for playing. Radio says, what are you most thankful for? I guess I'm thankful I don't remember the soup sucking bag.
No, man, that's too bad. It was during the stack. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. I don't know. I'm thankful that we can still do the show and we still have fun doing the show. And
yeah, you know, that's a good one. Stray Bullet says, if you could steal one thing from your co-host Nerd Wall, what would you take? I know. I would definitely take the Punisher slippers so I could wash them, because they have not been washed since they came from the pit. How dare you?
They have been professionally washed numerous times since then. You've got some fun stuff in your background that I wouldn't mind stealing. I definitely wouldn't touch those lost VHS tapes you got back there, but
they're DVDs.
Maybe some Legos. I don't know. They look pretty wide. They look pretty wide. They look like you know, VHS tapes.
Yeah. Oh, great question here. This is from Derek Mainhard. Ask what's better.
You remember this bit?
Soup. Or a cheese
steak. Sucking on a cheesesteak. Sucking on a cheesesteak. Sucking on a cheesesteak.
I wish you wouldn't.
All right. Great. And then here's a nice one to end on. Stanley says, what is your favorite weather and season?
I'll go fall. I don't like being hot. I would rather be cold.
Fall's perfect.
Yeah.
55 degrees, so you can wear a jacket.
Yeah,
but it's not too cold.
I need a hoodie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh,
that's nice. There we go. Great way of wrapping up audience questions. Why don't we move to our next section, which is trivia? And for that, we're going to turn it to Pete LePay.
All right. This is a part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free to Midtown Comics Online, because if you had $25, you'd probably want some comics. All we need is a volunteer, a brave volunteer, to win $25 free to Midtown Comics Online.
$25, totally free, no strings attached. Come
That's
on.
Right. Come on.
Come on. Come on. Tell you what, if nobody does it, I will do it for a charity.
There you go. Oh, hey, we got David's in. David Quinley.
Yeah, wait, no, we have the Greater Good came in first.
Oh, man.
And this was exactly what I was going to do it for. The Greater Good 42 says, I'll do it. Donate to Hero Initiative. Absolutely.
Let's do that.
It is Giving Tuesday, so we got to do that. I believe Amber mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, shout out to Amber Love.
On. So, yeah, play trivia. If you lose, we will not donate $25 to the Hero Initiative. I'm kidding. Of course we will.
Okay, good.
Yes. All right, take it away, Pete.
All right, today's trivia is about the comic The Terminator's Santa Claus is Coming to Town and a small nod to the legend Michael Delano, R.I.P. Please listen to all three options before making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. Who draws this amazing comic The Terminator's Santa Claus is Coming to Town? Is it A, Kendall Good, B, can I get you a soft drink? Sorry, look who I'm talking to. See Ron Soda.
Do you think he feels weird about that? Ron Soda? Like when he orders a soda.
I think it's got to be a point of pride. You know what I mean? Unless he was picked on as a kid and like kids used to beat him with soda cans. That would have sucked. You know what I mean?
Beat him?
Well, depends on what...
They're choosing D. I feel like that's wrong.
Yeah, unfortunately, this, even though we only do fun D options when Alex isn't here, but guys, he's still here. I know Justin is gone, but come on. I mean,
we got an A plus D fun fact.
go on. Ah, fun fact callbacks. Oh, man, we did fun facts. Yeah, you weren't here, but it was a good time. Yeah, A is correct.
Okay, great. Let's get the next one.
Question number two, spoilers, but this amazing comic is hilarious. Who does Terminator dress up as? Is it A, Santa, B, reverse it and add an S, and you are the smartest, stretchiest man ever, bruh, C, Richard Reed?
Hmm. have a D Alex challenge.
Ooh.
What does that mean?
Well, that's also a callback to when you weren't around.
Yeah. Do I need to come up with a fun fact? Is that?
If you want to. People love a fun fact.
Mm. All right. I'll try to think about one for the next one. I wasn't prepared this time.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It was, what was Justin's fun fact? Oh, he won an award for his pilot.
Oh, a fun fact about yourself.
That's right.
Oh, I see. A Satan?
Or Santa, but close, and we'll give it to you. You can see how those get confused. I believe that's a Jack Black movie reference there. Last one, question number three. There is fun one-liners in this fantastic comic. Which line is from the comic? Is it A, Happy Holidays, bitch? B, if this is your real name, what's your poor name? C, Dick Steele.
Dick Steele. Where do you find these guys?
You know, it's right there in the IMDb notes. You know what I mean?
You gotta get these wonderful toys. Right? I gotta ask for an impression, so.
Yeah. No, Derek Mainhart, please. Can we just go one show where we don't see that stupid picture, please?
Which stupid picture?
Come on, man. Don't make me cover my...
This one?
So dumb.
The real picture of me with my real ass.
I hope someday KJ Apa sees you on the street and beats your ass, man.
Here's the thing. KJ Apa, I don't know him personally, but he would love this.
I don't think he would. I think that man earned those abs, and you're trying to take credit for them?
First of all, he'd be like, that's so weird. Those are your real abs, and they look exactly like mine.
No, he wouldn't say that, because that's his abs, I don't know, not yours.
KJ Apa has created this whole other personality called Mr. Fantasy, who is a musical artist. He performed in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. You got to read these things. We're on an audio podcast, Pete. You got to just cycle through comments.
Sometimes it's better if you check out the video. You know what I mean?
Jeez. God. I'm sure he said A at some point. Congratulations. Shoot us an email. We will donate in your name to the Hero Initiative. Or I'll just do that after we end up recording here. In the meantime, what was your secret movie?
Of course, we're talking about the 2001 hit Ocean's 11.
Great. As we all know, there are more than 11 comic books coming out tomorrow. Pete, what are you looking forward to that's going to be in stores?
I cannot wait for Wednesday to talk about some amazing comics.
Yeah, and of course you haven't read these, so...
I haven't. I'm just excited for them. Specific ones. Something is Killing the Children, number 45. I mean, this story has been solid. I cannot wait for this new issue. I love the art. I love the whole tone. It's been really badass and fantastic. Speaking of badass, Birds of Prey number 28. I mean, we've had like giant gargoyle Barda. It's been amazing. The art is amazeballs. I look forward to every issue when I hear it's coming out. This has just been hitting above its weight class. And of course, Salvi didn't think I was going to say it, but of course I'm going to say that Terminator, Santa Claus is coming to town. What doesn't sound fun about this comic? I mean, even you're looking forward to it. Come on.
Even me, and I'm a real Grinch, if you will. Yeah. I am looking forward to Giant Size Criminal, number one, is coming out from Image Comics. This is a new story from Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, and that is always a good time. Looking forward to the return of Inferno Girl Red. That was a massive first title, and that's coming back tomorrow with Volume 2, number one, and Hulk Smash Everything, number one, from Marvel. Ryan North doing, as far as I've heard, a bunch of ridiculous smash-em-ups, with the Hulk. In the first issue, I believe he takes on dinosaurs. Later on, he's going to be taking on a black hole, to give you an idea of that sort of thing. And these sort of dumb.
He's going to win, dude. I think he's going to win.
I think he will. But I can't wait for all of those. And all of those are going to be in our Stack podcast. It comes out Wednesday, 9 a.m., both of the Stack feed
and the
Comic Book Club feed. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Monica Joy and Gijo Sleeper for coming on to talk about Me, the Family Pet. You can check that out on Webtoon, TikTok, or YouTube. Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing for talking about
Legends.
IDW's Star Trek The Last Starship. Issue number 3 is coming out December 17th from IDW. Definitely check it out. Great series, as well as everything else that they've been doing. Next week on the show, Kenny Porter and Mike Becker are going to be here to talk about the new Space Age from Mad Cave Studios.
Yeah.
And Rodney Barnes will be here to talk about Woo-hoo! Crownsville. Back on the show, so that should be exciting. Comic Book Club News, our daily news show. Check it out every day of the week, Monday through Friday. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support the show and get ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. Comic Book Club on Blue Sky. Comic Book Club Live on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Thank you. Take care of yourself out there.
So grab your